Without further ado, I'll introduce our speaker for today, Phil Payson O'Brien, and he's in conversation with Dr. Peter Caddick-Adams, who I'm sure you know. It says in my notes that he was born in 1963 in America. I find it hard to believe the first part, but I'm sure the American part is true. And he's historian and professor of strategic studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, where he also serves as the head of School of International Relationships. He's talking about the World War II strategists, Churchill, Stalin, Roosevelt, Mussolini, and Hitler, and how the war made them and how they made the war. And at the end, he'll be signing books in the Waterstones tent at the end of this marquee. So, Phil, Peter, over to you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's very good to have such a full tent at such an early hour. I personally feel I still need a caffeine drip attached to my arm. So well done for all of you turning out. We're gearing this talk around Phil's wonderful book called The Strategists, which deals with the five main Second World War leaders of Mussolini, Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin, and their origins and their impact in the 20th century. And you know, just to remind you, not only is Phil signing copies in the Waterstones tent opposite, I mean, it is presumably a requirement that if you're coming to this talk, we don't let you out unless you buy a copy. So Waterstones are fully expecting to be run out of copies. But Phil is double-hatted, really, in the way I am, in a funny sort of way. I mean, you do military history and war studies, studying the past as much as you do the present and the future. So you're as good on Ukraine as you are on Sarajevo 1914, in both respects. So, you know, what brought you to write this book when it came out, rather than something more current or another era?
It's a good question. And it's interesting to see how your process would be. I tend to write books while I'm doing a project that I'm doing, something occurs to me and I go, oh, that's different. I didn't expect that. This is interesting. Something needs to be explored here. So the strategist sort of built on the two previous books because things were gnawing away. I wrote arguably the dullest book on the Second World War called How the War Was Won. If you want 250,000 words of data, please be my guest. But that was sort of an analytical view of what was made and what was destroyed in the Second World War. And what was interesting to me as I was writing that book was how the actually specific decisions of leaders changed a great deal, and how the war could have been fought very differently. Now, if you're an academic, a lot of the stress you have and a lot of the theories that are given out in international relations downplay individuals. Or something like realism basically implies all states behave the same. We're all about maximizing power, and it depersonalizes history. So there's a real sort of thrust in a lot of intellectual thinking to not talk about individuals, talking about phases or developments as if that matters. But actually, what really struck me as I was doing How the War Was Won was how specific individuals changed the course of not only what was built, but where it went and how it was destroyed, and that the war would have been very different. And so I became interested in leaders. You could say that there's a chapter in that, probably the least boring chapter, where I start talking about the grand strategists interacting with each other, basically Churchill and Roosevelt primarily. And then the next book I wrote was a biography of Roosevelt's chief of staff, William Leahy, who I think was a much understudied character. But what was interesting is writing that is to understand Roosevelt, you have to go back to the First World War. And that's actually when Leahy and Roosevelt met. They met in the U.S. Navy Department in 1913. They're very close throughout, from that time onwards, they become friends. But that actually their relationship is established before and during the First World War. Their strategic outlooks are established at that point. And that is very much what they bring to the Second World War. They are having many of the same discussions they had during the First World War and the Second. They approach the questions very similarly. And I thought, well, that's quite fascinating, to see that Roosevelt was doing that. So that what would it be if you went and looked at Churchill, Stalin, and Hitler, and Mussolini? And I think what I found is the more you went, the more you saw actually these are First World War soldiers, First World War leaders, First World War politicians in some cases. And really, in their minds, that was the great event of their lives. If you had asked them, Churchill, the First World War in 1918, this is the great event of his life.
Yeah.
And that's what they bring to the Second.
So there is an argument that the First World War was a long war that ended in 1945 with a 20-year breather in between.
Yeah.
And your strategists came of age and really matured in 1418, then had a 20-year chance to think about it before they were all elevated into positions of power where they were able to put their policies into and their thinking into practice. Is that basically your...
Well, that's certainly one of them. I'd say for Hitler and Mussolini, it's one war. If you are looking at Hitler in the Second World War is, in his mind, correcting the problems of the First World War. He wants revenge for the First World War. He wants Germany to be reborn. So Hitler is in many ways refighting the First World War and hoping Germany wins it. So you can make that connection directly to Hitler. Mussolini wants to, you say, finish the First World War job of making Italy a great power and an empire. So that is impossible without the First World War. Churchill's, in many ways, goes back earlier. Churchill's war goes back to the late 19th century. And it's a longer war for Churchill that I think goes back to preserving the British Empire and what Britain will be in the war. So it's not exactly the same, but certainly Stalin, absolutely. Stalin is a revolutionary. From the moment the Russian Revolution begins, he is in one war. And he is expecting a war to break out at any time at that point. So I think you can, in their minds, there is no break where there's sort of war cannot be expected.
So our study of the two separate wars is and pigeonholing them that doesn't help because in their minds this is the generation that happens to be born at the end of the 19th century and this is their life and it's one long continuous process. But Roosevelt, talk to me about Roosevelt because he's the outlier in terms of not putting uniform on, although he's Assistant Secretary of the Navy. In the First World War. So he does play a distinct role.
He did. I mean, Roosevelt never serves, though he kicks himself because he is thinking about signing up in 1918 after he makes the trip to France and Britain. So Roosevelt's background is relatively different than the rest because he, it's no point is in the military. Doesn't even serve in reserve officer training. He really is not military trained in any way compared to the rest.
So completely the opposite to his distant cousin.
Oh, absolutely, completely opposite. And emotionally quite different from Theodore as well, that Roosevelt is, I think, more of a skeptic. Franklin Roosevelt's far more of a skeptic than Theodore. And his view of war is, and this is something that really comes home to him in 1918. Now, Roosevelt is a young man on the make, and he's a very successful young man on the make. And the key part in his political career in making Franklin Roosevelt is when he becomes Assistant Secretary of the Navy in 1913, which might not sound like a great job, but it actually was the first job that Theodore Roosevelt had in national politics. So Roosevelt is aping his cousin Theodore by becoming Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And he's very lucky because the actual Secretary of the Navy is a North Carolina newspaper man who doesn't like boats. His name is Josephus Daniels, and he really is utterly uninterested in naval affairs. His one contribution to the U.S. Navy's history is that he's the person who bans alcohol on U.S. warships. So the reason you can't get a drink in the U.S. Navy today is because Josephus Daniels, who was a Southern Baptist anti-alcohol campaigner, becomes Secretary of the Navy. But Roosevelt is his assistant, and because Daniels doesn't care, Roosevelt plays a massive role in shaping the U.S. Navy running into and during the First World War, far more than the Secretary of the Navy. And one of the high points, we were talking about this earlier, was he makes a very important trip to Britain and France and Italy in 1918. And he comes to tour all of US naval facilities. It's, by the way, where he meets Churchill. And they have a really not a successful meeting. Roosevelt,
it's dinner, isn't it? Well, one of the inns of court.
Churchill, the fascinating thing is Churchill claims not to remember. Roosevelt definitely remembered, because in the 20s, he said to Joe Kennedy that Churchill was a stinker, which if Roosevelt's calling you a stinker, that means something. And Churchill was like, I have no idea, Franklin Roosevelt. But actually, I think that my guess is that's the problem, is that Churchill didn't pay Roosevelt the attention Roosevelt wanted.
Because Roosevelt met the king, didn't he? I mean, he's really important.
The king. Yeah, the king was savvier than Churchill. Churchill was like, who is this junior American politician? I'm not bothering with him. The king spent 45 minutes with Roosevelt, because I think the king had been better prepared. I think that was the problem, is Churchill really probably didn't pay any attention to Roosevelt, thought he was unimportant. And Churchill, Roosevelt remembered that. And I think actually that's one of the reasons their relationship in the Second World War has been mischaracterized by being very close and chummy. It wasn't that. That they got along because they had to get along, and they shared certain strategic outlooks, but they were never close personal friends in the way that I think that
I always wondered, because Churchill never went to Roosevelt's funeral, which he could have done, and I always thought it was a curious omission. But anyway, back to the
sorry, I can go on to that. Well, basically, Roosevelt makes this trip to Britain and France in 1918. And the first part is he tours British, American sort of naval bases and facilities in the British Isles. And then he goes to Bordeaux, where American troops are being landed. And from there, he goes to the front. And he actually spends some time in the front near Verdun. And what's clear, he hates the land war. It stinks to him. So he talks in these notes about just the smells. How do army officers take this, he would write. And how do they experience, Roosevelt's an aristocrat in an American way. He hates being at close quarters with all these people as well. He hates breathing their air. He said he spends a night in one of the Verdun forts, and he can't really sleep because there's so many people, and he's rebreathing their air. He says, "I don't know how they do that." It comes in. I think what it does in his mind is it.
So is he a claustrophobic or a hypochondriac or both?
No, I just think he in his mind doesn't want to be too dirty. And he really finds that's why he likes the Navy, because he considers naval vessels more hygienic, fresh air. He loves sea air. He considers that a big part of health. So he is just drawn to the Navy on many levels. But his vision of the war that comes out of that trip is just a really detachment from the land war, a view that the war and the land will be won by machines. It's not actually one he's going to be invested in a huge deal. And this is the period where he starts referring to, and he does this for the rest of his career, he refers to the Navy as us in the US government, and he refers to the Army as them, which, by the way, drives George Marshall nuts in the Second World War. But Roosevelt just instinctively always refers to the US Navy as us, or we, in the possessive.
So, but he's got a lot of common ground with Churchill in terms of their loving of naval affairs.
And their love of machines.
Yes.
And that comes out at that period too, that we were talking about this before. The really interesting, Churchill's probably the most studied human being, certainly in British history, but arguably in history. I would think there might be more books about Churchill than anybody.
There are more biographies in the English language about Churchill than any other person living or dead.
And there's only one period in his life which I actually think is not given the credit it deserves and the study that it deserves. And it's while he's Minister of Production for the last year and a half of the war. Because he's not in the war cabinet at this point. He's not sort of right around the decision-making structure with Lloyd George. He has to write memorandum to try and get his arguments across. And people don't pay attention enough to his thinking from 1917, 18. The First World War, I think, changes Churchill. The First World War makes Churchill grow up strategically. I mean, in 1914, he's still a bit boyish when it comes to war. So, you know, he's First Lord of the Admiralty. The war breaks out. He puts on a London livery company's uniform and runs off to France. It's ridiculous. You know, he's dressing up in a livery uniform because it looks military. And he, you know, tries to go to, and he goes to France. And at one point, he's going to try to take command of Antwerp or something. And
it's, as a major general, yes. He wants to be appointed a major general.
It's nuts. Yeah. You know, and then he wants to land on the German coast. And the Dardanelles, I actually am one of, he's responsible for the Dardanelles. And it's a very rash and boyish kind of way of.
Well, I think right policy, wrong time, and poorly implemented, probably. My view.
You're nicer than I am. But then what happened is the Dardanelles go so badly wrong that Churchill is forced out of power. He's given, you know, the killer job, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. You know you're going nowhere when you're made Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. And he decides to try and rebuild his political career to go to the front. And he spends 6 months at the front from December 1915 to May, June 1916. He's very lucky and completely fortuitous for him on timing. He comes right after the Battle of Loos and right before the Somme. Had it gone a few months earlier or a few months later, Churchill very likely would have been a casualty.
He takes over a battalion that's been annihilated at Loos and will be annihilated again on the Somme.
Absolutely. So had he come earlier or later, there's a very good chance Churchill would have been at least severely wounded in the First World War. But what he sees in France in early 1916 is unlike anything that he had imagined before. He sees trench warfare. He doesn't see a big battle, but he sees death every day. Someone hit by a sniper, a command post hit by a German shell. And he's just appalled at the attritional losses that are coming every day to the British army. He's like, we can't suffer this. You know, we don't have the population as Britain to suffer.
But he is losses. Unusual. I mean, he has enormous physical courage.
Absolutely.
And he's out leading his men into no man's land on raids and all the rest of
it. And he wants to save their lives. You know, he's the absolute opposite of someone like a Hitler or a Mussolini who wants to sacrifice their soldiers' lives for their greater glory. Churchill is a sacrificer early in his career. There's the battle of Kitchener's victory at Omdurman,
yep.
And Churchill is part of the Lancers charge, the famous charge, which almost goes disastrously wrong. And he's upset that not more soldiers had died, because if more died, it would be more famous. That's the young Churchill. The 1916 Churchill has grown up completely. And he's like, we've got to keep our soldiers alive. We can't suffer these kind of losses. And when he goes back to becoming Minister of Production, he writes memoranda that you could see he implements in the Second World War. Read Churchill's memoranda from 1918. I mean, if you're going to get your hands on government memoranda. But what he's saying is, we need to fight with machines, not manpower. We can't advance into enemy, you know, strong enemy defensive fire. We need aircraft and tanks. It's all about getting the machines.
I mean, he's in charge of the largest ministry. Yep. It employs more people than anyone else, yep. Has more factories, outputs. They buy and sell more than anything else in the country in 1917, 1918. Yep. And in terms of, you know, employing women, in terms of rationing, in terms of so much that he's got to implement in 1940,
yep.
he is at the coalface.
He understands it. Totally. He understands production probably better than any World War II leader. I mean, Roosevelt understood production because he was American president and he realized America had a lot of production. But Churchill understands the mechanics of production.
Quick undergraduate's course in logistics.
Yep, and he never, you know, it forms him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that experience of 1917, 18 absolutely forms him. And he brings that in 1940 when he becomes prime minister. As soon as, you know, it's clear France is going to fall, what he does is he prioritizes construction. He goes, okay, what do we need? Yeah. And he makes Beaverbrook the minister.
And also gives him land and sea, yep. Insights. Which I don't think we can say any of the other leaders have, because they're either tied to land or sea.
It makes him very wary of land warfare.
Yeah.
I mean, the you might say the meta strategic narrative of Churchill in Europe in the Second World War is not to invade France. He never wants to do D-Day. It is one of he's finally bludgeoned into it by Roosevelt and Stalin at the Tehran conference. But Churchill is dogged in his determination not to do D-Day, up, even tries to scupper it in 1944 after he's signed on the dotted line. And it's because he literally believes the British will suffer too many high losses fighting in France. He has enormous respect for the German army, which comes out of this time in 1916, when he's at the front, and indeed what happens in 1917-18. And the last thing he wants to do is send a mass British army fighting in France in 1943-44, which in his mind would be a rerun of what we have seen in the First World War. So that stays with him throughout. And it's why when he finally has to agree to D-Day after Tehran, he has a nervous breakdown. You know, that Churchill has this period where there's conferences with Roosevelt and Stalin. It's basically Cairo, Tehran, Cairo. And they are the crucial ones for determining the end of the war in Europe, because it is the one that agrees D-Day. And after those conferences,
his health is shattered, isn't it?
His health is shattered. I mean, he has what we would call panic attacks. You just have, you know, different eras called, but different things. His heart starts racing. He can't breathe. He can't get out of bed. He can't focus. And, you know, he is a depressive, admitted depressive. And I think he's so overwhelmed by the fight against D-Day that when it finally loses, he has a bit of a nervous collapse. And they're not quite sure he's going to pull out of it. At one point, he thinks he's dying.
His personal doctor thinks he's going to, pneumonia is about to get him at the end of 43, beginning 44, I think it is. So we've got this, very good cover that shows how they are networked together. Yeah. What do they all think of each other?
Well, that's a really good question. By the way, the cover's great. I had nothing to do with it. The only thing I did is I moved one of the pins off of Churchill's nose. Because it's covered with these pins and
probably
strings.
Can't see it, but five photographs and a sort of spider's web
of these things. And one of the
you'll
pins,
see it when you buy your copy.
One of the pins was right on Churchill's nose, and I thought that was a bit too much. So that's my sole contribution, was to move one of the pins. They did actually think about each other a lot. So they were judging each other, both allies and friend and foes, so that they were making their judgments either way. That, gosh, I'd say, what did each think about the other? I think the really interesting relationships are the allied ones, the Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, Hitler, and Mussolini. Hitler does obviously have fondness for Mussolini. It's very odd, that Hitler really believes he never abandons Mussolini. He remains loyal to Mussolini because of the Anschluss. That when Germany illegally occupies Austria, it takes over Austria, which was a direct violation of the Versailles Treaty, and actually is quite threatening to Italy, because it's moving Germany to the Brenner Pass. So it's getting rid of Austria, which is a buffer state, which the Italians had always wanted as a buffer state between Germany and Italy. And Mussolini agrees to Hitler taking over Austria. And Hitler is actually quite overwhelmed, because he thought Mussolini was going to be a big problem.
Is it not that fascism started really in 1922, and it's the model of everything that Nazi Germany is and becomes. So he owes, take Mussolini and his black shirts out of the equation, and you don't have a Nazi Germany.
Yes, though I do think it's more personal with Mussolini. Hitler's view of the Italians is never quite convinced. He's never quite convinced that the Italians are going to be this great military power that Mussolini is trying to
portray them as.
And that really goes, in his mind, 1939-40 is a disaster for Hitler in his view of Italians as a military power, that there is a real blow. Mussolini actually makes one clever decision that, had he kept with it, we would be looking at him very differently. And the clever decision is, in 1939, he does what Italian politicians do in 1914, and he stays out of the war. Hitler goes to him and actually says, in August 1939, Benito, I'm about to invade Poland. You're with me, right? And he assumes that Mussolini will come into the war at that point. It's very important to German strategy, because what he thinks is that Mussolini's navy will tie down the Royal Navy in the Mediterranean, and it will allow him to have a free hand to attack Poland. But what happened is Mussolini says no.
Chamberlain originally turns to him to mediate peace.
Well, Chamberlain has a huge faith in Mussolini. Yeah. He believed Mussolini was an honest broker at Munich, which of course is a tragic view to have because Mussolini wasn't. But Mussolini really disappointed. I mean, Hitler has a crisis in August 39 when he gets the letter from Mussolini saying, well, I can only fight if basically you give me all your natural resources. I mean, Mussolini doesn't say no, but he makes such impossible demands. And Hitler, that's a real blow to Hitler because he believed Mussolini was his friend. And the thing that sort of, I think, cements the doubts is then Mussolini decides, oh my God, what if I've missed the bus? You know, so Mussolini is such a horrible figure from the rest of 39, early 1940s, because he's like, oh, what if Germany does really well? Maybe I should have joined. I mean, he really is, I might have missed out my opportunity to be a
great. And he does in June, and the last possible moment.
And the Germans treat him with contempt. Yeah. When he does. So by the time, you know, Hitler even calls it a sordid, you know, this is sordid, that Mussolini, when he joins, is joining when the French are on their heels and about to collapse. And for Hitler, this is just tawdry in his rather bourgeois sense of...
So the two sets of allies sort of meet one another, the Germans, Italians, and the big three. But Hitler doesn't meet Churchill ever, does he? There's a near miss that, with a hotel meet set up in Munich.
Yeah, none of the Allies ever meet any of.
Do you think that would have made a difference if they had got the measure of just how bent on power and military domination Hitler was in the late 1930s? Might that have informed particularly Churchill?
I think the fascinating thing would have been if Hitler ever met Stalin. That would have been the very interesting meet. On the one hand, you know, Stalin was a drinker, smoker, and loved meat. So I can't imagine the meals with Hitler would have been very exciting. Because, you know, Hitler picking at his pasta and drinking mineral water while Stalin's sitting there. On the other hand, Hitler and Stalin shared certain...
Common modus operandi.
Common views of the world and how quickly they agreed the Nazi-Soviet pact. Which is a pact of extraordinary importance that is negotiated in a few hours. It really happens very, very quickly. So could they have, had they ever gotten together, could they have agreed some kind of kind of pact? Probably not because of Hitler's views, but that would have been, I think, the interesting meeting had it ever occurred.
Now, sort of reflections, and I'm you know, we've done just over 30 minutes, and we're going to do about sort of 40 chatting, and then hopefully what we've done is seed the room for questions, so there'll be 20 minutes worth of questions. You know, before we head in that direction, the amazing thing is their impact, their shadow is incredibly long. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody knows the names, and you know, what's going on in Ukraine today is you know, allegedly down to the shadow of Stalin and his policies on Putin. Churchill's shadow has never really left. You can't enter or leave a secondary school today without doing Holocaust studies about Hitler and Mussolini. You know, and Roosevelt is the sort of the gold standard of the decent internationalist sort of Democrat in a way that, you know, the Republicans completely moved away from. So they're all there as sort of baselines in their own countries and internationally.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Ukraine, because both Hitler and Stalin viewed the control of Ukraine as arguably the most important physical area of control for both of their countries. So this is Stalin in the Russian Revolution and the sort of civil war that happens afterwards and the war with Poland. But you have to remember, for the Soviets, the First World War doesn't really end probably till 1921. You know, it's the First World War followed by the Russian Revolution, followed by the Civil War, followed by the war with Poland, which is one of the, very rarely is a war understudied, but the war with between Russia and Poland is actually understudied. Very important war. Stalin has a very senior military command in that war. He commands sort of half.
That's really where he comes to fore, isn't it?
Well, it's the second military. I mean, he has the first military command that he has. And he's the political, the Red Army has a weird structure throughout the Russian Civil War and the Russian Revolution, because there's a military commander of the Red Army, but then there's also a political commander. So, and ultimately, you know, who controlled the army was sort of up for debate. And since Stalin was such a powerful political commander, he often could overrule the.
And of course, his big, big battle was the defense of Tsaritsyn,
yep,
which we later know as Stalingrad, and you know what part of the investment of the 1942-43 campaign. It's not just the name; it's that he's been there before, and he was the man,
and he understands logistics. I mean, it's a fascinating thing that Tsaritsyn is a very important transport hub in southern Russia. It's on the Volga. So it controls river communications up and down the Volga, but it's also, perhaps more importantly than being on the Volga, it was a railway network, and it's where you would get grain to Moscow in the winter. So if you're going to get your grain from the Caucasus to Moscow, it would all have to go through Tsaritsyn. So during the Civil War, the control of that railway is absolutely vital to the Bolsheviks remaining in control of Moscow. And it's a sign of Lenin's confidence in Stalin that he gives him the political job of overseeing the defense of Tsaritsyn. There's a Red Army commander, and then there's Stalin as the political commander. And it reveals a lot about Stalin's nature. The first thing is, he's always ideological. So the first thing Stalin does when he goes anywhere is say, who are my enemies? Let me kill them. Yep. No, I mean, that's absolutely what he does. And so he will go, and enemies are not just open enemies. It reveals there are always lots of hidden enemies. So if you're Stalin, there's lots and lots of enemies. And so he will, you know, instantly distrust all former Red Army, all former Imperial Russian officers who are now fighting for the Bolsheviks. He always tries to get rid of them and purge them. And he does tend to choose really stupid people who will follow his orders. So it's at Tsaritsyn where he elevates probably the worst commander of the 20th century, Voroshilov. Who becomes his number one military guy for most of his career, and is a true incompetent. And Voroshilov is promoted from Tsaritsyn because he will do everything Stalin says, and he never questions Stalin, Voroshilov. And so they meet each other, and that's where Voroshilov comes under Stalin's
spell. So much of this is setting up for the Second World War.
Entirely it's setting up for the Second World War. The one thing, I mean, and Stalin's a bit of a disaster at Tsaritsyn, but what he, I think, comes to realize is, oh, I screwed up, but as long as I recover my reputation, I'm okay. So it's very much, you know, he screws up, and then, okay, I got to be practical and salvage myself here. He has that practicality that Hitler doesn't have, that Stalin is able to pivot and in the end make the practical choice to save himself, which is why I call him actually the worst and best grand strategist of the Second World War. And people were a bit confused. But what I meant, from 1939 to 1941, Joseph Stalin might be one of the worst grand strategists in history.
He nearly loses the country.
Not only that, but he actually makes the person setting out to destroy his country stronger. So he signs the Nazi-Soviet Pact on a miscalculation. His calculation is that Britain and France and Germany will fight a long war and exhaust themselves, and at the end, he can then walk in. But what he actually has done is made it so that Germany will not fight a long war, but will conquer France, because he's given Germany the one front war. He's given Germany a lot of resources. So he's, in many ways, enabled the fall of France, which was not his intention. So he makes Germany much more powerful with the Nazi-Soviet Pact. And then when Hitler starts massing the German army on his border, Stalin refuses to admit the truth that he has created this juggernaut in the German army, and the German army is about to invade him. He's getting the kind of intelligence reports you can only dream of. These are from Russian agents in Germany and Japan. He's getting, the British government is saying, look, the Germans are about to invade. In the end, the German ambassador sort of lets the rest of the Soviets know the Germans are about to invade. And Stalin refuses to believe it because that means he screwed up.
It's not helpful when a national leader turns around to his national intelligence agencies and says, losers, low-grade losers.
Yep. And basically disinformation. You're feeding, it's very much like deep state. But what saves Stalin is what happens when the invasion occurs. Because he has failed. He has utterly failed at that point. He has set his country up for disaster.
Do we think he has a nervous breakdown?
He certainly retreats to his dacha, which if you've seen the movie Death of Stalin, that's the actual dacha. They filmed that in Stalin's, I think they pulled the wool over Putin's eyes and said they were going to do like a documentary about Stalin. And so the Russians are really angry that they were allowed to film Death of Stalin in Stalin's dacha, but that was the dacha. He certainly retreats to that dacha for a few days as the battle opens and the German army is streaking through Western Russia. We don't know if he has a breakdown or just whether he doesn't know what to do. Now, what he, I think, is thinking is that the people are going to come now and arrest him and shoot him for incompetence, as he would have done. All right? If Stalin had been number two and that had been Lenin, sorry, boom, you're dead. I'm going to take over, you failed. So Stalin is in his dacha, in many ways, I think, expecting the worst. But what happened is he had so destroyed the personality of anyone else in the Soviet government that they could never even think about that. They come to him and he's expecting to be arrested and they just say, please come back, Joseph. We can't work without you. And he's stunned. But that is really important because if there's one period in his life where Stalin, and trust is too strong of a word for Stalin, he realizes these people are so weak that he can work with them. So he will, he works with that Soviet government because he knows they could have killed him and didn't. But then he pivots quite extraordinarily and says, okay, I'm going to get what I can from the British and the Americans. And he does it extraordinarily successfully. And that makes him a very, very good grand strategist in terms of getting resources and building up the Red Army and from 1941 to 1945.
I mean, this is what I like about the book, because you emphasize so much that this is about really the willpower of five unique individuals. None of this is inevitable.
It's the
personality of these people that happen to arrive in the middle of the early 20th century, what they do then, and how they develop and mature in ways that no one else can match, and we haven't seen their like before, probably since someone like Napoleon. And it's difficult to see their like since.
You could say Mussolini and Donald Trump, I suppose. But that I think it does need to be a focus on leaders, and I do think that is something we are seeing in our world.
But their leadership models are all different; they're not the same. It's not five different versions of one. It's five completely radically different types of leadership.
It's a question actually I've wrestled with, and I don't know if I have the answer to it. You go into it thinking, all right, Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini are dictators. Churchill and Roosevelt are domestic politicians for democratic states, and thinking that will make a difference. But oddly, when it comes to authority, they almost all have the same amount of authority over their armed forces. I mean, Roosevelt.
Well, how much they choose to exercise.
How much they choose to. Roosevelt is commander in chief of every member of the U.S. armed forces, as Donald Trump is now. The president, in some ways, in the United States, has more authority over the military, particularly then when you didn't have anything like the War Powers Act constraining you. That the president has, and you have a declaration of war. I mean, if you are a president of the United States with a declaration of war, you can basically do anything you want because you are commander in chief of the armed forces. So Roosevelt is as powerful as Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini over the U.S. armed forces. I mean, Churchill is probably the most limited because he's not commander-in-chief. The monarch is commander-in-chief, though that really doesn't matter. But Churchill even makes sure his power is as high as possible by becoming Minister of Defense. So that's the idea of the First World War, Churchill in charge of production. First thing he does is he makes not just the prime minister, I'm minister of defense as well. so I'm going to take control of the formation.
The first time we've really had a Ministry of Defense is into the bargain. So he's creating, crafting this machinery of government to exactly his own requirements.
And they all, by the way, sort of sideline their foreign ministers, because they handle the really big issues themselves. So Eden...
Because they don't have summit meetings before.
If Eden's sent to a meeting, it's not really that important. Or, by the way, if Cordell Hull has anything to do with American decision-making, you can be sure it's irrelevant. Roosevelt hates Hull. Roosevelt actually doesn't trust anyone in his cabinet. Doesn't really, cabinet members for Roosevelt are political appointees to satisfy constituencies. So it always drives me crazy when people talk about Stimson as if he matters. Roosevelt doesn't like Stimson, doesn't listen to Stimson. Same with Frank Knox.
Secretary
of War. Frank Knox is the Secretary for Navy. Roosevelt trusts, basically in the war, Harry Hopkins and Bill Leahy. Those are the two.
Personal advisors.
At some point I get too American. I apologize for that. But Roosevelt, Churchill is also very similar to that. Churchill trusts the people he knows from the 30s. So if you come into Churchill's orbit during the Second World War, you're never fully trusted. It's the people who stuck with him in his mind. And that's sort of dissimilar, you could say, to the rest of them, that you had to have some earlier attachment to them for you to have some authority.
Good, right. Well, that's plenty of thoughts there. Hopefully we've seeded some good questions. What I'd like to do is take a question from the left, center, and right. We'll take three questions together, squirt them at you, and then hopefully we'll have room for another three and possibly another three as well. So there's a question over there. What I'll do is I'll just sort of... So we'll answer them at this first batch at the end of three. So if you wait till a mic comes for you, and then if we spot... Yeah.
Thank you. One of the most cataclysmic events of the Second World War was Pearl Harbor. Mm. It certainly suited Churchill and Roosevelt not to realize the intelligence of what was gathering beforehand. What is your view of that situation?
Pearl Harbor.
Okay, so we'll park that one. One in the middle.
Thank you very much for a fascinating talk. I was intrigued to hear that Churchill was against D-Day. I hadn't ever picked that up before. Just be interested to know what his alternative strategy was for that.
And then one over here, this side. Do we have one? Yep, just behind. There was a hand over there. Yep.
Thank you. Could you comment on Stalin's strategy in terms of Imperial Japan and what Roosevelt thought of it?
Well, those are three great questions. Pearl Harbor is a really... there's a lot of, I would say, conspiracy theories that Roosevelt knew the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor, and therefore he left the American Navy out to be sacrificed. He knew the Japanese were probably going to go to war. But the idea that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor specifically was still something quite extraordinary, to think of massing all their aircraft carriers in one very vulnerable exposed force, sending it across the Pacific. And by the way, it was very different than the American Navy's concept of naval operations. So the American Navy's concept of naval operations in the 30s, which Roosevelt was very heavily involved in, was for a battleship force to be mustered after the war begins, and then to sort of deliberately go across the Pacific to crush the Japanese in battle. It was not, they didn't...
Do a Jutland.
Yeah, to do a Jutland with a battleship force. So I think he just didn't understand what the Japanese were capable of doing. There was a general view, that this was not something to be. They thought the Japanese were probably going to go to the Philippines, because their view is it's a resort. What the Japanese are going to do to go to war is they're going to need oil, because he has triggered the war. In some ways, Roosevelt consciously made a war inevitable when in July 1941, he embargoes oil on Japan. Japan doesn't have a drop of oil, okay, nothing. It has to import all the oil it has, and it, by the way, was importing almost all of it from the United States. So the United States was the Saudi Arabia of the world 1940-41. It was the great supplier of oil. And in 1941, and I won't go into the details of why, Roosevelt embargoes oil on Japan. So he really has put a gun to the Japanese heads. And he says to them, in a few years, you're going to run out of oil. You're done. You know, you're going to, if you don't do what I want, which is ultimately to get out of Vietnam and actually out of China. So he has made a war very likely, unless they back down. Now, part of Roosevelt is actually looking at it rationally, which is a problem. The rational view is the Japanese will never really attack us. They're 1/20th our size economically. It's like saying Belgium's going to attack us. That can't be. So part of him is thinking that the Japanese will just have to back down because of the reality of the economic balance. He doesn't get the Japanese mindset. But then he also just can't, you know, he can't get his head around Pearl Harbor. On the other hand, he thinks, and as the U.S. Navy has been told, there is a war possibility, you should be on footing. But the Japanese do things that they never imagined, the way they're able to shorten their torpedo. You know, there's so many things the Japanese do at Pearl Harbor that are quite extraordinary. I just don't think the Americans thought they could carry it off. But that, you know, Roosevelt causes Pearl Harbor in the sense that he causes the Japanese to go to war. He's not unhappy with that because I think he wants to get in the war with Germany from the moment France falls. If you're going to look from Roosevelt's point of mind, he is stunned in May, June 1940. He doesn't think the United States will have to get into the war before that, but you know, he had been to France. He had a great respect for the French army, a bit like Churchill. And he really thought that France would fight well in 1940. And when France falls from that point on, he wants to get in. So Pearl Harbor, in a larger sense, yes, he knew something was going to happen, but he didn't know it was going to be Pearl Harbor. But it, you know, he bears general responsibility for starting the war, just not the specific Pearl Harbor. Churchill and D-Day. Well, there's so many things. What Churchill does is, he sort of says, I don't want a large mass land army to fight the Germans. By the way, the Russians can do that. That's fine. I want to fight them two ways. I want to fight them with an air-sea war. So it's about strangling Germany on the European continent with air and sea power. And there, when I want to fight, it'll be smaller land formations in the Italy or the Balkans, what he calls the soft underbelly of Europe. And it's not so much, I think, that even that he wants to fight there. It's just that he knows he can't have mass armies there. Because it's you know, people, I think, always think he's obsessed with the Southern Europe. It's not that he's obsessed. He just likes the idea of fighting there because it's going to not be so casualty-centric.
He's also spent most of the 20s painting on the south of France, so he knows that.
He knows that well. And I have to say, Churchill in some ways doesn't get the credit he deserves for keeping British casualties down in the Second World War. That the British fight from 1939 to 1945, they fight in the Pacific, they fight in the Atlantic, they fight everywhere. And their casualties are shockingly low. If you go look at most British towns, there'll be a First World War memorial, names after names after names after names after names, and they often whack on a small Second World War memorial. And that's because the losses are about half in the Second. And I think you can tie a lot of that to Churchill and the way he chooses to fight the war is that he doesn't want to have a mass casualty kind of conflict. And you know, if I'm in the British Armed Forces, I'm pretty damn glad Churchill's in control of my overall grand strategy as opposed to a Joseph Stalin or an Adolf Hitler, who is very happy to have me die for their greater glory. So I don't think he gets the credit he deserves.
Imperial Japan.
In terms of...
The question over here. Would can we just go back to that question?
Stalin and Japan. Yeah, I mean, Stalin is, and he does this very well, he's keen to absolutely keep the Japanese out of any war with him at that point. And he's laser-like focused on peace with Japan. So once the Red Army actually slightly embarrasses the Japanese army in Manchuria-Siberian border in 38, from that point on, he has very good relations with the Japanese because he doesn't want a two-front war. And he does that quite successfully. I mean, the reason he's able to send the Siberian army to fight the Germans in 1941-42 is because he can take the risk of undefending much of Siberia. So he puts a lot of effort into it. He has very good relations with the Japanese during the war. People, I think, sometimes think, Axis and Allies, but it is not an Axis and Allies relationship.
Yeah, there's a big lend-lease program from the West Coast to Russia, which the Japanese never...
The Japanese allow the Americans to ship goods to the Soviet Union through Vladivostok, which they could easily have tried to stop. So the Japanese also, want to get along with the Russians. And then as the war goes on, it becomes a bit absurd because, once Stalin is confident the war in Europe is going to be won, he starts planning to attack Japan. And the Japanese have a very fantastical view of Stalin at that point. They think, Stalin's our friend. He might help us negotiate a peace when Stalin's getting ready to invade them. So the last few months of the relationship is really bizarre because the Japanese are trying to get along with Stalin, to use Stalin as a conduit to Roosevelt. But actually, Stalin just wants to invade them. So he's stringing them along. So it's a fascinating relationship.
Let's take another three questions. So that side of the room.
Brilliant talk. Historians always love parallels. And I'm just wondering, if looking at a contemporary parallel, that the relationship between Stalin and Hitler was extraordinarily similar to the relationship between Putin and Trump. Both of them regarding almost everyone else on the board, playing on the board, as just pieces to be traded for, moved out and swapped and everything else. How would you agree with that parallel?
Well, that's a good one. This gentleman right at the front here.
You talked a lot about the importance of the Allied leaders' senior experience in the First World War and the imprint that left on them. But how much do you think that Mussolini and Hitler suffered by contrast as strategists from having just been NCOs in the First World War?
Very good question.
And then over there,
Love the book, and thank you also for all the Substack work you do on Ukraine. The question is, which of the strategists in the Second World War can you see parallels in today amongst people like Trump, Xi, and Putin?
I might actually combine the first two questions, the first and the last question, because they're quite similar. The Putin-Trump relationship isn't, I wouldn't say it's actually that analogous to Hitler-Stalin, because Trump seems to want Putin's approval. And they talk a lot on the phone. That Trump as president has had regular conversation, hour and a half, 2 hour conversations with Putin. And he boasts about his friendship. So in Trump's mind, the relationship that he has with Putin is very different than the relationship that Hitler and Stalin had with each other. They never met. They only met through intermediaries.
So do we think Putin has a hold over Trump in some respect or other?
Trump is not an agent of Russia. He might act like one. but he is not Krasnov, a recruited Russian agent, as some people have said. What he is had a longstanding connection with first the Soviet Union. Going back to the 80s, he has a very pro-Russian outlook. He has enormous and as yet unknown financial relationships with the Soviets and then the Russians, stretching now to the billions of dollars and connecting to his cryptocurrency, his family's cryptocurrency relationship. So massive financial incentives. And I'm sure he misbehaved when he was in Moscow as a young man. But the relationship is not one of a recruited agent. He honestly seems to like Putin or want his approval. It's very odd because he's a narcissist and he doesn't seem to want anyone else's approval except Xi. He likes the approval of strong men, as he said. So he likes the approval of people like Xi and Putin because that maybe makes him feel that he isn't that kind of caliber. So I think the relationship is not, it's not the same. Hitler and Stalin both were bastards, historic bastards. But they were in many ways, I think, more ruthless and more just different than that. In terms of the parallels, I don't think history never repeats itself. It rhymes or whatever the phrase is. I think what we see in the parallel is the individual leaders can make a massive difference, Putin being the primary one. The world that we see, the Russia-Ukraine war, and also much of the relationships of the United States and Russia now, have been heavily shaped because Vladimir Putin is the Russian leader. He decided to invade Ukraine in February 2022. No other Russian leader had to do that. No one put a gun to his head. Indeed, if you watch that press conference, most of his advisors didn't want to do it. Yeah, that
This is when he threatens everybody.
It's an extraordinary event that he does a few days before the invasion. He does a televised press conference or meeting with his advisors, and he's basically forcing them all to publicly say they want to invade when none of them want to invade. And he berates them, he insults them, and yes, in the end, they all have to say they want to invade. You know, but he is the one driving it. Yeah. Remember that one. He's driving it. And no other Russian leader had to invade Ukraine. And as a war leader, in that sense, he's a catastrophe for Russia. On the other hand, he's been instrumental in easily the most effective influence operation in modern history, which is the way the United States has been, I think the pro-Russian narrative has been adopted by the Republican Party in the United States, which is quite extraordinary. So, I mean, what we do see is a lot of Putin's fingerprints unsuccessfully and successfully in where we are. So I think the world would be very different if there was another Russian leader, not Putin, even if it was a Russian dictator, not Putin, the world would be very different.
And then NCOs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, Hitler comes out of the First World War. He's the lowest ranking. I mean, Mussolini is also not high ranking, but Hitler is the most common soldier. He's a corporal, which it's the high point of his life is enlisting in the Bavarian army, which needs to be said. He signs up for a Bavarian regiment, which is originally a separate command structure from the German army. But before that, he's a nobody. And he's a really bad artist living on the fringes in Munich. And signing up for the German army gives him this extraordinary purpose. And I think it's difficult to
He's a failure, everything he does, until 1940.
Yeah. And then actually, he's not a bad soldier. He's also a craftier soldier than people think. He gets a job as a runner, which is much nicer than being in the front line. He has to take messages to and from the front line, which is absolutely dangerous work, but he gets to sleep at headquarters and he gets better food. So, you know, he's crafty.
And he gets two Iron Crosses, which is unusual for an officer.
And one of them was suggested by his Jewish commander. But his view of the war comes from, the ground up. And he has this intense focus on German technology and German success. He believes German equipment is the best in the world, German artillery is better. When he first sees a German tank, he has almost a sexual experience. He honestly believes in firepower. And that is the First World War. From his point of view, artillery is easily the most difficult, dangerous thing. And he is living in fear of artillery every day of his life, even at headquarters, because headquarters are commanded. So that is, he is very much fighting that, which is why the German army in the Second World War has so many freaking horses. It doesn't have the trucks and vehicles, because he doesn't prioritize that in his creation of the German army. So even when he invades Barbarossa, he basically scours all of Europe for every truck he can get because he's not provided the German army with trucks. And even at that point, he can only actually mechanize about a quarter of the German army. The rest of it's following on footstep behind. So the First World War is there. The other thing with Hitler is that the army experience of 1918 we were talking about is absolutely vital, because in 1918, which is we look at it as the last year of the war and Germany's about to lose. But from Hitler's point of view, Germany's about to win. Germans launch their spring and then the Michel offensives of 1918. Hitler is excited and he believes the German army is about to march to victory. He's there. He sees all these troops being transferred from the Eastern Front. He sees the trainloads arriving with a million German soldiers. And he is absolutely convinced the German army is going to march to victory. And you know, he's rhapsodizing about it in June, up to June 1918. And then it all goes to hell. And he also gets gassed and he ends up in hospital. And when he comes back from the hospital, the war's over and they've lost. And so he's like, oh my God, we had to have been betrayed. There's no way the wonderful German army could have gone from victory to collapse in 4 to 5 months.
Because he wasn't there. He wasn't there to stop it.
He wasn't there. Well, also, something must have undermined them. And that's really where the hatred of the Jews, he blames the Jews for weakening the German ability to fight.
Well, there we are. What a wonderful tour de force. We've dived into the 21st century.